Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a pleasure to say we are joined by the proprietor of the Economic War Room, a program that you can find at economicwarroom.com and Blaze TV. His name is Kevin Freeman. He is our duty expert around here on economic warfare matters, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, the founder, president of a terrific organization, the National Security Investment Consultants Institute. He is the author of a couple of very important books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. And I'm always delighted to have him with us. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us again. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Frank. Always good to be with you.
There is a master of the universe on Wall Street by the name of Stanley Druckenmiller of the Duquesne family office, who has apparently put down a warning that sounds very much like what you've been saying for quite some time about the possibility of the reserve status of the dollar being seriously imperiled by the conduct of monetary policy by the Fed at the moment, and the government of the United States more generally in terms of printing dollars. But talk a bit about that warning and what we should do about it.
Sure. Well, Stanley said that he's never seen monetary policy so out of line with the economic reality, and that's the case. So we're pumping money into a system that is slowly recovering, but we're just creating massive amounts of liquidity, both from the monetary side, but also the fiscal side. We're overspending in every possible respect, so much so that you have people that are out of work getting government benefits, but they're not all that interested in taking a job, at least not at what's being offered them. So we have employers wanting to hire employees. We have a high unemployment rate, but the employees aren't so interested in going back to work.
As we speak, Kevin, in prospect, and when this program airs this evening in the rearview mirror, the president is sitting down with Republicans and Democrats for a change to talk about still more federal spending, specifically on what they call infrastructure, some of which doesn't bear much of a resemblance to infrastructure, certainly as we've known it. This would presumably only intensify the problem you're talking about were it to eventuate.
Well, there's no question. I mean, we have close to $30 trillion of reported federal debt today. The president has offered another $6 trillion or so of suggestions. At that pace, there is no way that the dollar remains the reserve currency, and there is no way that the United States remains solvent. What will happen is that no one will buy our debt because we just keep producing so much of it. And you produce so much of something, and its value goes down, and our debt will go down in value, and we will not be able to fund this massive government that we have. We will have to raise taxes, which is already being proposed. This is a death sentence for the economy if we continue down this path.
And there are those around the world who, of course, are only too keen to see that reserve currency status removed, notably the Chinese communists. And there's a lot of talk at the moment about cryptocurrencies. They're offering one. And we're hearing Elon Musk at Tesla now backing away from accepting cryptocurrency for Tesla vehicles over concerns about this environment, social justice, governance agenda, because apparently it's a rather dirty business as far as they're concerned, the amount of electricity required for mining these cryptocurrencies. Talk about that quickly, if you would, Kevin.
Yeah, with cryptocurrency, particularly Bitcoin, requires so much electricity that the mining is more than some nations of the world in electricity use. But the reality of it is that we have all of these things popping up at the same time, some of them competitive, and none of them promoting stability. We're going into an everything bubble, and we're watching all of this craziness happen, which is going to drive massive inflation. It's taking us back to times like the 1970s, where you have pipelines shut down and you have gas shortages. All of that we're seeing a repeat. Something we covered on our show in an episode several months ago that was titled Things Have Changed. They've changed back to the 1970s.
Yeah, back to the future. And when you look at that, Kevin, obviously inflation is, or stagflation, as it was called in the day, I guess, was a blight on not just the economy, but on the American people. Is that what you're anticipating is going to be a problem yet again?
It's not what the media is saying. They're saying that this is transitory. But when you have wages going up, demands for $15 an hour, people not willing to go to work, energy crisis, all of that, that doesn't seem transitory. We're facing a new inflation. It's the natural result of the Biden policies, increased regulation, increased taxes, and really poor energy policy. You put it all together, and this is what you get.
And it may be with us for quite some time. And if it is, it is likely to compound the kinds of problems that you were just describing, especially if it does wind up sort of reverting us to a 1970s kind of malaise, as I recall, is what Jimmy Carter used to call it, wearing his sweaters as he turned down the thermostat in the White House. Kevin, let me turn to one other piece of this, and you sort of touched on it there a moment ago, the pipeline problems. Colonial Pipeline says it's coming back online, which would be a great mercy if that happens. But what are the insights that we should take away from what went down with respect to this piece of critical infrastructure? And do you think the right lessons are being learned from it?
Well, no, they're not learning the lessons. Number one, infrastructure is vulnerable. It's vulnerable to hacking. It could be our electric grid. Number two, they likely did it for profit, probably came out of Russia. But if you can shut down a pipeline, you can buy up gasoline futures and make a fortune. And that's likely what they did. It's economic warfare, pure and simple. They can do it over and over. And the final thing is if it's bad to shut down pipelines via hacking, why is it good to shut them down by government mandate? And so the Democrats are pretty caught here. They want to shut down, Whitmer wants to shut down the pipelines through Michigan and so forth. No, America needs pipelines. It's a part of our infrastructure. It's what keeps this nation working. And if you close them off, it causes huge implications.
But this is, unfortunately, as you say, Kevin, part of an agenda. The so-called Green New Deal, among other things, envisions weaning us all, or starving us all, as the case may be, of access to fossil fuels, whether they're pipeline delivered or rail car delivered or otherwise. Let's talk just very quickly, if you would, about what we're seeing, among other things, in this infrastructure legislation that the Biden administration is advancing that would essentially impose that agenda on the rest of us.
Well, President Trump had an all-energy policy that got us energy independent. They're going the reverse. Again, it's going back to the 1970s, which is incredible. Energy dependence. We won't give up our fossil fuels. We'll just import them from other nations. Or if we do give them up, we will freeze in the winter and we won't be able to drive our cars. As Jimmy Carter said, put on a sweater and you had to go every other day before you could get gasoline. All of these policies lead to a failure of the United States. This is how you take down a great economic power and turn it into a third world country. And we're seeing those policies being implemented daily.
Back to the future, perhaps back to Venezuela, as President Trump used to say. Kevin Freeman, a chilling forecast and one that I hope will be heeded in terms of corrective action, among others by negotiations on this infrastructure legislation and government spending. Thanks for your time today, my friend, and the great work you do at the Economic War Room and the National Security Investment Consultants Institute. You can find out more about all of that at economicwarroom.com. We'll talk with you again soon. Thank you, Kevin. Next up, we will be speaking with Kyle Scheidler, the director of the Homeland Security Program at the Center for Security Policy, about Antifa, what it has in mind for you. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back and joined now by one of my colleagues and friends at the Center for Security Policy. He is Kyle Scheidler, the director and senior analyst for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism at the center. He has specialized in both the threat posed to our country by Islamist groups operating in the United States and Marxist ones that have come to the fore, particularly in the past year, in the persons of Antifa and Black Lives Matter radicals. Kyle has been testifying and writing extensively on this subject, and we're always grateful for his time. Welcome back, Kyle. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. Good to be here.
Well, we're speaking in the midst of what is said to be National Police Week here in the United States. It's not entirely clear that the police are being honored as widely as they should be, and as that designation certainly encourages. I want to talk with you a little bit about that, especially at a moment when we are seeing continuing violence on the part of Antifa activists, notably in places like Portland, Oregon, but I think elsewhere around the country as well. We're endlessly told that the problem actually is, of course, white supremacism, but this continuing violence, Kyle, and the sort of agitation and organizing that's behind it should be very much on our mind as well.
Yeah, absolutely, Frank. And, you know, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen a number of incidents from BLM and Antifa style protests, taking over streets, blocking cars. And this is a particularly dangerous tactic for a couple of reasons. First, for the physical safety of both the drivers and the protesters. We frequently have cases where, you know, either drivers are not aware that the protest is going on, and so they try to drive through it, or they become frightened by the protesters, particularly because they routinely assault the vehicles, and then they attempt to flee, right? And so you have this situation where vehicles are driving through crowds, which is obviously dangerous. But then you have these Antifa guys who are often frequently armed, open carrying rifles or concealed carrying pistols, and they are very keyed up on these roadblocks. And that, you know, you have a high degree of risk that they will shoot one of the drivers. This is, I think, partially due to propaganda. Ever since the events in Charlottesville with the death of Heather Heyer, the Antifa guys have pushed out this propaganda that they are going to be run over by white supremacists at any moment. And of course, they blame any driver who doesn't do what they want as being a white supremacist, you know, even scared soccer moms or the like. So they are keyed up to expecting a threat. And then, of course, the drivers are fearful as well and have a right to be. So these roadblocks are really dangerous. And we saw that in the last couple of weeks, both in Portland, Oregon, as well as in Plano, Texas. We saw some positive action from the attorney general down in Texas, where he called the local government in Plano to account, asking them why they are not doing more to prevent this kind of bad behavior on behalf of Antifa. So that was a positive outcome from a pretty ugly situation.
I gather the mayor of Portland is also finally beginning to step up and call out some of these folks. But it doesn't seem to be translating into a diminution of their agitation or worse, their violent threats. And again, some of these people in these cars have had their cars badly damaged. One fellow was drawn out of his car and or truck, I guess it was, and had an armed altercation with some of these folks and got very badly beaten in the process. So this is evidence of a sort of continuing festering of this problem. And I gather, Kyle, that your assessment, as that of others of our colleagues, is that these guys remain prepared for much more widespread activity, perhaps even revolutionary activity. Is that correct? And I'm talking about, in this case, both really Antifa and Black Lives Matter organization.
Sure. Well, you really need to understand these kinds of violent roadblocks and checkpoints as a form of revolutionary activity. They are taking over and acting as though they were the police, as though they were the authorities. And demonstrating the ability to do that is an important aspect of any insurgency, Frank, as I'm sure you know. And so when they make their calls for police abolition, and when they claim that they will provide their own security, they are making a revolutionary or an insurgent claim. And it's one of the reasons, in addition to the obvious public safety issue, it's one of the propaganda reasons why it is very important that law enforcement not allow them to do this. They should not be allowed to set up roadblocks and checkpoints. They should not be able to block public conveyance, because doing that allows them to posit themselves as the true authority in the area. And if you let that go on too long, you end up with situations, as we've seen in Portland and Seattle and elsewhere.
Where, among other things, people are declaring autonomous zones, sort of no-go zones. We'll be speaking in a moment with Michel Garfinkel about the challenge posed to the future of France by a combination of Islamist and Marxist forces. And I want to talk with you, Kyle, about how you see the danger of such a joining of forces in our own country.
Sure. Well, obviously, you know, ties between the hard left and the Islamists and the jihadists go back a long way. I mean, you'll remember, Frank, after the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, it was the National Lawyers Guild which provided legal aid to some of those defendants. So this idea of the hard
a communist front, the National Legal Guild.
That's correct.
National Lawyers Guild.
The same front, by the way, that provides legal services for Antifa, right? Not a coincidence. But we are starting to see, I think, an increasing merger of talking points and about the way these two movements, although they have different end states, they are talking about issues in a similar way. And I think it's instructive. I mean, a good example of that is there was a protest in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, where it was led by a number of known Muslim Brotherhood fronts. You had American Muslims for Palestine there. You had, of course, Council on American Islamic Relations playing a role. Representative Andre Carson spoke. Representative Rashida Tlaib spoke. You had the usual calls for genocide, you know, chanting from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, which, of course, calls for the erasure of Israel. But one of the things that was interesting and a little different was that they heavily emphasized this situation of Sheikh Jarrah, this Jerusalem community, which is filled with Arabs who have been evicted because of a variety of reasons. Some of them are legitimate, are illegitimate squatters, and some of them simply, you know, haven't paid their rents or have overstayed their leases or whatever. But in any case, it was a long legal trial in Israel, and they were evicted. And this has become one of the major propaganda flashpoints of this whole incident in Jerusalem. Now, why should that be of interest to us? Well, these sorts of eviction defenses are the same kind of justification that groups like BLM and Antifa use for their daily rioting in Portland. It's almost tailor-made for the American radical to buy into and to support. And we, in fact, saw that happen because on social media, we had a number of Antifa-linked accounts that were promoting this protest in the exact same language that they would have promoted one of their own protests. And I thought that was very interesting.
You know, Kyle, I'm so glad you brought this up, both because of the parallels here, as well as the dangers that they represent to our freedoms. But we have a special webinar that the Center for Security Policy is going to be sponsoring tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And I really encourage our listeners to tune in for a deep dive on what is going on in Israel at the moment in terms of these attacks, not just in Jerusalem, but now from Gaza and the very distinct possibility that we're at the cusp of a major conflict that could be one that engulfs the region or perhaps even beyond. And I hope that our listeners will check this out. You can register for it at securefreedom.org. Fred Flights, the center's president, will be moderating a very important panel discussion on the subject. Kyle, let me just close out on this subject with you. To the extent that we're watching this convergence between the left and the Islamists, it presumably means that the Islamists are prepared to aid in and otherwise abet the kind of insurrectionary activity that some of these guys have in mind. We won't have time to really dwell on this, but is that in short something that you think is in prospect?
I think it's definitely something that we should be looking out for, Frank. you'll remember that after the incidents in Ferguson, we saw a number of attacks on police officers that were conducted by individuals who whose backgrounds were very suggestive, that they had either jihadist tendencies or open Islamist membership. But at the same time, they also had ties to a variety of Black supremacist organizations. And so it was an interesting nexus. And it's it might be a sort of a mistake to try to figure out which one of those two ideologies was more important to them, and instead say that they found resonance with both.
Yeah, they, at least with their immediate purpose of bringing us down. Kyle Seidler, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for the terrific work that you do at the Center for Security Policy and for joining us periodically. We look forward to our next visit with you, even if your warnings are very ominous indeed. God bless you, my friend. Keep up the good work. Next up, we will speak with Michel Garfinkel about the threat we're now seeing to France and what it might mean both for the French, obviously, but also for the rest of us right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to a friend of many years with whom we have not been in close touch. And that's more the shame because he has been busy on a very important mission, along with a large number of retired French military officers and now quite a number of serving military personnel as well, in a remarkable effort to raise an alarm about what is happening to his nation, France, and the prospects that things may eventuate there that would be horrific for the French people, but probably for lots of others besides. Our guest is Michel Garfinkel. He is the editor-at-large of Valeurs Actuelles, which is a very important publication in France and has been the vehicle for bringing forward two important letters. He is a public intellectual of the First Order and a Shulman Ginsburg Fellow at the Middle East Forum, as well as the founder and president of an organization that has been known in the past as the Jean-Jacques Rousseau Institute and is changing its name momentarily to the Colloquium 7. Michel, it is so good to have you back. Welcome and congratulations on the great work that you have been doing and the help you've been giving to your military in raising this alarm. Let's talk a little bit about the nature of their warnings.
Thank you so much, Frank. The situation in France, just like in other Western countries, is quite worrying for many reasons. There is a global feeling that French society, French as a nation, has forgotten the true values that has that have kept it alive for so many centuries. And of course, we will have elections very shortly, the regional elections in France, and we will have national elections next year. But even so, there is a global feeling that the Republic might be imploding, in fact, in this country.
Wow. And that the prospect now is one of civil war, is what these senior retired military officers spoke of. And it seems as though this is being echoed now by this anonymous group of serving military personnel. And at the core of this, as I understand it, Michel, is a growing concern about a phenomenon we've been seeing a lot lately in the United States, too. And that is this idea that France is a racist country and anti-racism must now, you know, cause massive changes in the nature of the political life as well as the character of the country. I got that right?
Yes, absolutely. And in some way, you know, the French like to indulge into some kind of criticism of everything American. The French have a love-hate relationship with the Americans. What is true is that in many respects, the type of so-called anti-racism that we see now in France looks like a copycat of what you have in the United States.
This so-called critical race theory and the anti-racism agenda. And in France, of course, it's not so much black folks who are in the forefront of this movement, as I understand it, but those who are Muslim, or more to the point, what I call Sharia supremacist in character, many of them hailing from North Africa or being supported by the Turkish government. Is that right too?
Absolutely, absolutely. I would say that this redrawing of French identity is basically supported by a lot of people of African origin, including very recent immigrants and from Africa. There is a reality today that Africa is very young, is undergoing a demographic explosion, and that quite naturally a lot of Africans are just moving north. If they are not in one way or another deterred from just landing north of the Mediterranean, they will do it, because the incentive is to, just like many people from Latin America.
Indeed. We're familiar with the syndrome. But let me ask you this, because we'll run out of time before there's things to talk about. The reaction of the French government to these letters from military personnel, retired and serving, has been harsh, I think it's fair to say. And it rejects the thesis, I guess, but it's more critical of the people who are propounding the concern that there is going to be a civil war if there's not a course correction, right?
I want to be very specific about what the officers, the generals, did say. It was not a call to insurrection. There was nothing seditional about what they wrote. They just said that the country is now undergoing a crisis, and if the government is not doing what the law, in fact, requires it to do, France might slide into a civil war. When you have a growing numbers of people who say that they don't belong actually to the French people, the French nation, and they want to impose a kind of non-white supremacy over the original European white people of France, we are coming very close to a terrible, terrible race-based civil war. So what the generals did was to warn the government and to ask the government to act. It was not a call to sedition or to rebellion.
And it needs to be said that in France, there are areas of the country. I remember several years ago, the French government sort of acknowledged these so-called sensitive urban zones. There's called them no-go zones. Some 750 of them, as I recall, that are essentially off limits to French authorities. This is of concern, obviously, but does this specifically, as I recall the letter, it alludes to this problem that there are parts of the territory of France that are no longer French?
We are not talking about zones anymore. We are talking about walled cities and walled counties. There was a case, for instance, 2 months ago. Yes. There was a or counties even, you know, really. You have, when I say counties, counties in France are in part like states in the United States. They are important subunits of the government, you know. So, for instance, we had the case of one high school teacher who resigned. He was teaching philosophy at a high school at Trappes. Trappes is a big suburban community close to Paris, and to Versailles. And he resigned because he said, it's impossible now for me to teach philosophy has been conceived in France traditionally. Why? Because the city he was teaching in, Trappes, has become a kind of autonomous Islamic emirate, and he cannot do anything anymore.
And this is enforced by the example of a teacher elsewhere in France who was literally beheaded over having spoken to his class in a way that was considered to be offensive to Islam. And this really raises the larger question, Michel. We're going to talk a little bit more in a moment with Jeff Nyquist, who's been studying closely what Valeurs Actuelles has done to catalyze this very important debate in France, and what the takeaways should be for us, and a letter in the United States that some 124 former general officers, flag officers, have signed recently that isn't identical by any means, but it seems to have a similar kind of urgent appeal to a course correction by our government. And so we'll talk about that more with him. But I did just want to have as a sort of quick aside with you, what you have helped accomplish, I believe, with these letters and their publication and the debate that they have helped inspire, some of it quite heated on the part of the government, though, to be sure, is a vital service, I believe, not just to France, but to Europe more broadly, which is facing many of these same, many of the countries at least are facing many of these same forces. And also for us, you know, the free world more generally, it is a formula for our undoing if we fail to understand the threats that those who seek through their supremacism of whatever stripe, ideological, racial, or otherwise, to really destroy what we call in this country e pluribus unum, you know, out of many one, and the fundamental principles of constitutional republics. We appreciate so much your time today. Michel, I hope you'll come back for a longer visit about all of this. It's overdue, and there's much more that's unsaid about what we've been talking about today that needs attention. So come back to us soon if you would. But in the meantime, thank you for your great work, the Valeurs Actuelles, and at Jean-Jacques Institute, soon to be called the Colloquium 7. We look forward to talking about that with you as well soon. Next up, Jeff Nyquist on the U.S. counterpart to the French effort and where we stand. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to one of my favorite guests. He is J.R. Nyquist. Jeff is a brilliant essayist, strategic analyst, and author of, among other things, The Origins of the Fourth World War and The Fool and His Enemy. You can follow Jeff at jrnyquist.blog and at J.R. Nyquist on Twitter, as I do. Jeff, it's so good to have you with us, especially because I know you've been giving a lot of thought to the topic that we just discussed with Michel Garfinkel, namely the degree to which we are seeing military officers of great repute in France and now here in the United States raising alarms about the directions of their respective countries and the implications for the rest of us if there are not urgent course corrections made. Michel talked with us about the prospect of civil war in France if those corrections are not made. I'd be interested in both your thoughts about what the French warnings in Valeurs Actuelles have signaled for that country and what those that have been issued now by these flag officers for America, as they call themselves, mean for ours.
Yeah, well, it's interesting how the left reacted in France to the general's letters. And you did have misrepresentations of the letter, people suggesting it was seditious. The French prime minister called it disgusting the left sees it as breaking the rules to have written a letter. Now, clearly, they were very careful when they wrote this letter. Clearly, they knew exactly what they were doing. They were very careful and guarded. They did not propose sedition. They were just telling the government what was going to happen if the government did not do the right thing, because the government is not defending France. And this pressure is building up. And there's Islamic and Antifa violence. They're destroying the culture of France. They're threatening the integrity of France. And the government must defend France. But of course, what does the government do? It attacks the messenger. It attacks the generals for saying it, which has caused a discussion in France. What you really see happening in the French magazines, and it's spilled over now to other countries, a discussion about what it means to defend a Western country from Islamism, from Marxism.
And the combination of the two, which is especially dangerous. And you've described the French government as anti-French and indicated that you think that the Swedish government is anti-Sweden. And that, for that matter, the U.S. government at the moment seems to be pretty anti-American. This does seem to create conditions under which these authentic insurrectionists or revolutionaries are free to operate, and raises, it would seem to me, Jeff, every bit as much a concern here about where this would ultimately leave us if, as I say, we don't change the trajectory of this enemy within problem in our own country as well as overseas. Now, the general officers in this country, the 124 of them signed on to this open letter, didn't hold back on some of the specific problems that they see with the government policy here. If you could talk a little bit about that difference and the significance of perhaps this effort translating, as I hope it will, into a rallying point for not just the kind of discussion that you're talking about in France, but the kind of public movement behind a different course, a different trajectory for our country.
Well, of course, the letter of the French generals was aimed at the government. The American flag officers was aimed at the American public. But what's going on in both countries is the same, in the sense that the government, the officials, they're not for us as Americans or for us as French men. Something has happened, and of course, I bring up in my essay the question of lions and foxes. The in Pareto's theory, of course, an elite consists of two elements, and it's borrowed from Machiavelli. The lions you need for their courage, and the foxes you need for their cunning. And it's ideal if you have both types, but if a society becomes too wealthy, too comfortable, the foxes end up in control and the lions are ostracized. And the foxes, of course, are very cunning, but they're also not honest. And when they have complete control, you have the kind of situation in the governments in the West that we have now, where they have foxes and they want to negotiate everything, and they fail to be able to confront the Marxists and the Islamists.
And when you're dealing with Marxists and what I call Sharia supremacists or Islamists, if you will, you typically find people who are cunning and, if not necessarily courageous, certainly ruthless. So, Jeff, when you look at what arguably are the roars of these lions on both sides of the Atlantic, what might we hope for in terms of, on the one hand, popular sentiment being affected and course corrections, for want of a better term, being adopted by our governments? I was struck by a report I saw the other day of a poll in France that indicates a very substantial majority of the French agree with the critique of these generals and other military personnel in France. I don't know that that's the case here, but I think it would be if a poll were to be taken. But what are your thoughts as to where do we go with all of this?
Well, I think what we're having is a discussion about defending. And of course, this is what the foxes won't do. They won't confront the enemies of their countries. They want to accommodate them. And they want to instead create a rhetoric that makes anybody who wants to defend a bad guy. Because then there's a risk of conflict. And what the foxes just don't want is any conflict. But of course, there's going to be a conflict because the Marxists and the Islamists are going to push to have their way, and somebody has to stop them. And so the society as a whole now has been, you know, sort of brought into the consciousness, into the awareness that, hey, wait a minute, our soldiers, they want to defend us. Our government is not defending us. We're not even allowed to talk about it. So we're going to talk about it. We're going to have a discussion. And of course, in France, they're much more restricted in what they can say than we are. We have freedom of speech. They really don't, because they have these laws protecting Islam. You can't criticize it. You know, we've heard what has happened to Brigitte Bardot in France. So now people have been encouraged by these brave men who've spoken out to speak out. The government really is put in a position of having to punish people who the vast majority of their countrymen think are right.
Because this may be an untenable position for the government and maybe conducive to the sorts of changes that are in order, hopefully on both sides of the Atlantic, as I say. Thank you so much, Jeff. We have to leave it at that for the moment, but we will be back to you next week with what for on these sorts of cultural, intellectual, and ultimately strategic challenges and what we best be doing about it. Thanks for your time today. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us. I hope you'll do so again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. During Barack Obama's first two terms, he made a priority of embracing Palestinian, Iranian, Muslim Brotherhood, and other Sharia supremacists and undercutting Israel. This reckless regional policy conformed to a broader strategy of treating enemies better than friends. Today, in what some call Obama's third term, the Biden-Harris administration is making the same mistake with potentially catastrophic consequences. Having emboldened jihadists from the Houthis in Yemen to the Taliban in Afghanistan to Hamas in Gaza and the mullahs in Iran, we are reaping the proverbial whirlwind. All these U.S. adversaries are attacking our friends with impunity. Joe Biden insists America is back. We're back, all right, to being perceived as an impotent foe and an unreliable ally, ensuring we'll have more enemies and fewer friends and a vastly more dangerous world. Retired senior military leaders are urging a major course correction. They're absolutely right. This is Frank Affney.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.